I found that you could seal solid KLF in a glass tube with carbon tetrachloride and then heat it up. Now, at the higher temperature and the higher pressure that's in the tube, I could completely dissolve the KLF. So this was a new solvent I had found, but you had to do it under a slightly elevated pressure and a higher temperature. I think I found some other solvents also. Well, having found this, I conducted light scattering experiments and got estimated molecular weight from these. And I had to have elevated pressure and temperature for these light scattering experiments, and this made the experiments extremely difficult to do, but I did build a light scattering machine. It took a long time to build the thing. I was not much of a pusher at getting the shop to push along, and I think the company was a little bit discouraged with my slowness on that, but I did come out with the only physical chemical stuff that they ever had on that KLF polymer. My colleagues would tell me that this was just a pet project to some of the bosses and that KLF was doomed to ever be any use to them. And that's proved to be true. They spent an awful lot of money, and it spent many years before I ever came to General Electric working on this thing. All the money went down the drain, as often does in research projects. I don't know that I recorded the date that I started work for the General Electric Company. It was the 8th of October, 1948. The company would size up all its new employees. We had the title of research associate. It's the only title that they had for their scientist, research associate in those days. Everyone was a research associate. The director of the laboratory was Chauncey Guy Suits. He'd been a protege of Coolidge, who had been one of the former directors. He was a rather pleasant fellow and fairly young. I liked him, although I had cause later on not to like him. Don't believe I was treated fairly at all. The synthesis of diamond business, that's recorded elsewhere. The head of the chemistry section in which I was located was Abraham Lincoln Marshall. There was an analytical section, analytical and physical section, under Liebhofsky. Can't seem to think of Liebhofsky's first name. He was from Texas. He knew Eyring because he'd gone to school the same time as Eyring up in Madison, Wisconsin. I don't know why I can't think of Liebhofsky's first name. Herman Liebhofsky. He was always giving up smoking, but the guys used to say he just did it so he'd have an excuse to borrow cigarettes from other people. Which he was always doing, because he'd given up smoking. That one he had to have one, he didn't have one of his own, so he bought it. I liked Herman. He was an interesting character. There was a mechanical investigations department within the chemistry section, which was a little unusual. It was an outgrowth of the wartime problems on jet engines and combustion in jet engines, and Tony Nerad was in charge of that section. There was no one definitely over the organic section. The rightful guy to have been over organic chemistry would have been Bill Cass, but when they formed a very definite department, it was given to a fellow named Elliot, and many of us were surprised at this, thinking Bill Cass was the person. As a matter of fact, we thought that Bill Cass was the logical choice to someday be the vice president of research and succeed Chauncey Suits, Guy Suits. He went by Guy. But After I had left General Electric, Cass also left because he hadn't been given his just due. I know he worked for Arthur D. Little Company. I met him there one time when I visited Arthur D. Little, and he and his wife had a barbecue chicken dinner for me. I lost track of Cass since then. I don't know where he is or what he's doing. Cass was a very likable guy who really tried to do right by everybody. Raymond Fuas, a Jewish man, professor at Yale University, physical chemist, famous one, I think had worked for General Electric at one time. At any rate, he was a consultant for General Electric while I was there, and he would make a visit to GE once a month. And he would talk to me a lot, and I got to like him. I was asked to do some viscosity studies. I have an early paper on that. I did it with Zamini and Ed Brady, and I've forgotten the details of that. I wrote these papers, and as I remembered, I did most of the work on this particular project with Zamini and Ed. But there is a paper there. Now, I think that that is the major work I had done concerned with this KLF business and that sort of thing. And by the time the fall of 1951 had come along, which means I had been there about 3 years, I hadn't received much in the way of raises. However, there was one interesting thing. You're not supposed to talk about what you make in a company or a university or anything else, but they do. And I learned that these young fellows straight out of college had received $5,900 a year salaries. I also found that I could hold my own and was just as knowledgeable, had just as good a background in science as the guys from Harvard and Yale and MIT and the other places, which was very comforting and reassuring because I'd worried about this when I'd gone away to school, gone away to General Electric. Most companies were doing their hiring from the premier universities, Princeton, Yale, Harvard, MIT, Caltech, etc. But I could hold my own with them, no problem. Furthermore, I was being paid $6,200, they were being paid $5,900. Now, these fellows were a little younger than I. I had been married longer, had more kids, and I had wartime service. Most of them had not had the wartime service. This may have been a factor in the reason I had received higher pay. I mentioned that the company tend to size up its new people. Abe Marshall, the boss of the chemistry section, would make it a point to take each new guy in his Lincoln Continental to some meeting someplace. And during the course of this meeting, size a guy up, and I was sized up. And you were sized up for the possibilities of using you as leaders in the company in administrative positions. Now, Abe Marshall, this was before the days of thruways. The New York Thruway was being slowly built at that time. Some stretches of it may even have been open, but there were routes like Route 20 and whatnot, but Abe Marshall always traveled the back roads, and he drove at tremendous velocities. He had all these neat instruments on his Lincoln Continental. He'd have an outdoor temperature thermometer, indoor temperature, a humidity indicator, and a compass, and all the other things. But he would go 75 miles an hour on roads that were good for 40, maybe. He'd give us instructions on how to, at a meeting, learn all you can for your competition, but don't give away any General Electric secrets and those kind of things. The early meetings I went to were in the field of high polymers. He was trying to get me oriented in that direction because a great deal of General Electric's interest was in the high polymer plastics area. The other guys were getting raises right along, and I wasn't getting any. They weren't liking me too well. Now, I think it's the fall of 51, the company decided to start this diamond synthesis project. About 30 of the chemists were called into a meeting with Liebowski, and was told us there's going to be this big secret project to make diamonds, and they need a couple of chemists to work on the thing, and I was the only one who volunteered, so I got the job. Now, the diamond story is told elsewhere on a tape that lasts at least an hour, perhaps 2 hours. I don't believe it's been typed up yet, but at least there's a real tape at home somewhere in our home in Provo on this subject, so I won't say anything about that. But this diamond project was, of course, the most interesting project that I had while I was at the General Electric Company. Back to the church in Schenectady. I was right away made the Sunday school superintendent while we were still in the YMCA building, which was close to downtown Schenectady. Well, it was actually in downtown Schenectady. Later on in the branch, I don't know all the jobs that I held, but specifically I was a district councilman for a long time. That's like a high councilman, but we're not in a stake. It was a branch. Our territory extended from the Canadian border on the north all the way up and down the Hudson River to West Point on the south. We were responsible for all the Latter-day Saints in that area. There was a kind of a branch of four cadets at West Point, and we had to take our turn at going down there and holding meetings. We put many, many miles on our automobiles in those days, running around, looking up members, and visiting and preaching and so forth at the branches. We had a branch in Gloversville, very small branches other places, like I believe Hudson Falls. You'd hardly call them a branch, just a very few people. There was something at Kingston, Poughkeepsie, Crown Point. At Crown Point there was the Merrill family, and Leo Merrill, who later on went to school and eventually worked his way out to BYU, got his PhD, and he's been working with me at BYU in high pressure for a long, long time. I'm officially the director of the data center, but he runs it. His father still lives up in Crown Point, New York. We had many interesting experiences. The New York Thruway in those days, and it may still be the same, was designed to be a thruway that went through the countryside. It didn't come close to the towns. And then there'd be a long exit, several miles long, to go from the thruway onto a town. The thruway exits were about 20 miles apart on an average. If we're driving late at night after being out working at one of these branches and missed a turn, you'd have to go 20 miles down to the next turn and then come 20 miles back, total 40-mile distance, and this happened on several occasions. We'd go in the Catskill Mountains and look for people. I remember some woman who was Latter-day Saint down there and wanted to divorce her husband. I was assigned to that case, and we worked and worked with that. John Clegg and his present wife, who was just a girlfriend at that time, Helen Brown, I believe was her name, before she was married. I remember we were all in my car working with that lady, trying to convince her not to divorce her husband. I don't know what ever happened. I recall one time getting word that there was a Latter-day Saint family living way up north towards Plattsburgh. There's a branch at Plattsburgh nowadays that there wasn't in our day. There wasn't a church near Plattsburgh. As a matter of fact, I ought to mention that during my Navy career, we had great difficulty in going to church. Many people in the service had automobiles. We never had an automobile. There was nowhere we knew to go to church when we were in Hollywood, Florida. There was no place to go to church when I was in Plattsburgh, New York. no place close in the Great Lakes area. However, we usually got off weekends. And I'd go clear down to Chicago and go to the North Shore ward. Of course, when I was on the ship sitting in San Francisco Bay, I always had weekend leave, and I would usually go look up my friend Frank Davis, who lived in that area. He'd moved down there to work for Itel McCullough, who invented the first truly good high-power electron tubes. And he lives in that area to this day. I'd go visit him and go to church where he went to church. Excuse me. When we were in Boston, in Cambridge area, we went to church there at the Cambridge branch, which was in those days met in an old home, a large home, and there was an older home that was the mission home right next door. In Brunswick, Maine, there was no place where we could go to church. There may have been something at Portland, Maine, but we had no transportation or way to get there. The Latter-day Saint servicemen I knew who were in the Navy, on the ships, or this, that, and the other with me were non-existent, except for my first assignment at boot camp. There was no one in my company that was Latter-day Saint, but there was a Ken Porter who now works at the BYU in the alumni development fundraising area, who was in another camp there who was Latter-day Saint. In Honolulu, Hawaii, there were no Latter-day Saints in any of the outfits I was in, but of course I had weekend leave and I would go to the branch there in Honolulu, Hawaii. I might tell you one interesting experience while I'm backtracking. I had one Jeep ride during the war in Honolulu. By the way, Honolulu wasn't very well developed in those days, with dirt roads around the island and to a great extent. Open air meat markets, flies all over the meat, and everybody going around barefooted without shirts. A lot of the, particularly all the native people. But I got to take this Jeep ride with some guys up to a high spot. I think I know where that high spot is. I forget what they call it. It's where the wind blows hard. And that Jeep ride was so hard. And then the Navy arranged for a bus ride clear around the island that you could pay $1.50 or something and go on. And I went on that one day. And we came around to one place where there was this... we hadn't been seeing anything on the bus ride, just a little bit of the ocean and the volcanic rocks and trees. And then suddenly out of nowhere, as we come around a bend, here is this lovely, beautiful building. And everybody looked out the window, "What's that? What's that?" "Hey, a club. Maybe we can get some beer." And of course I recognized it. It did take me maybe 10, 15 seconds to recognize it. It was our Hawaiian temple, just out in the jungle in those days. No paved road, no nothing. And then they were told by the driver, we're stopping here. This is the Mormon temple. You can't go inside, but you can go over and look around. Aww. Everybody thought. But when they got over there and started to look at it and walk around, they changed their mind. This was a really beautiful place, you know. And of course, they had questions what went on in there. What's this all about?